in-laws with Peter Falk and Alan Arkin. Okay, so about maybe about 20% of the people in the room, 25. Okay, so there is a scene, and the people laugh. And let me tell you something. I hate slapstick comedy. I hate physical comedy. Like, I much prefer, like, the slow, boring, painful development, character development movies or a good romantic comedy. But for some reason, I think because I grew up, and I saw this movie with my dad and my brother, and we laughed so hard that we thought we were going to die. But in this movie, The In-Laws, there's a scene. Alan Arkin is this completely rogue CIA agent, and his daughter is marrying a young man whose father is played by Alan Arkin, who is a completely rigid, perfectionistic dentist. And then you've got the other father-in-law, who is the rogue CIA agent. Well, as you can imagine, in a movie plot, he brings the dentist along on this huge caper across the country. And there is a scene where they get out of a plane and the plane takes off. And so they're in this open, completely open airfield, and they start getting shot at by snipers. And Peter Falk's advice is to this character is serpentine shell, serpentine. And so he contends that if you run in a zigzag pattern like this, you won't get shot. And so in this scene in the movie, Alan Arkin's character serpentines and makes it to cover. And then he has to go back out because the car keys are in this dead guy's pocket. So he goes, I'm going to get the car keys, the dentist does. And he goes back to get the car keys and runs straight back safely to cover. And this is where Peter Falk goes, you didn't serpentine. So he runs back out into the gunfire and then does his zigzag. And so it's just this crazy, funny scene. And so when I was listening to the research participants talk about one of the ways that they armor themselves against vulnerability is they totally serpentine. They have this thing in front of them that's going to be difficult to do, give feedback to an employee, have a difficult conversation about sex with their partner, make a difficult call to someone who's just experienced a loss. And what we end up doing is using tons of energy and time. And we go back and forth and we try to figure out how we can get around it. I'll leave a pot roast. I'll make a call. I'll send an email. Maybe I won't. Maybe I'll just blow it off. It's not that important. As opposed to running and walking straight into what we need to do. So one of the ways that I can serpentine. Like if I have something vulnerable I have to do, that would take 10 minutes and on the energy barometer, 50 points. 4 hours and 600 points later, I still have not done it. I have cleaned the house. I have washed the car. I have sewn something that I don't even really sew. I have done everything you can imagine. I am like serpentining like a mat. I mean, and to me, it's a great metaphor because whenever I'm doing that, one of the ways I always pull myself back to reality is I say, serpentine shell, serpentine. Like I'm doing it. And just to acknowledge that we're in the middle of avoiding is extremely helpful because as you can imagine, the funny part of it is if you're in an open airfield and people are taking shots at you, running in a zigzag pattern is not helpful. What's really helpful is the fastest point to where you need to go, the most thoughtful point to where you need to go. I think we all do this. It's avoidance. I think we all do this to some extent. But the trick about vulnerability is just like practicing gratitude in the midst of foreboding joy. We have to have something that clicks or that shivers that reminds us what we're doing. And so that's why I like these catchy kind of metaphors like serpentine. Floodlighting is another very interesting way that we armor ourselves against vulnerability. And it is simply, you know, one of the questions I get all the time, it's probably on the minds of many of you sitting in here today or listening, is, isn't there such a thing as too much vulnerability? What about oversharing? Isn't that an issue? Too much vulnerability, by definition, is not vulnerability. Oversharing, not vulnerability. I call it floodlighting. So the reason we share and we tell our stories with people who've earned the right to hear them, as we talked about again earlier, is that when that happens, when I reach out to you and I practice vulnerability and I get brave and I say, I really got criticized for this piece that I wrote last week and I'm just in this place of total regret. My feelings are hurt. When I show up and do that, and then you show up in response and give me what back? Empathy that we talked about yesterday. It creates these really beautiful tiny lights of connection, of courage, of compassion. I use twinkle lights as a metaphor for that. Just these tiny, tiny sparks of light. And in between them, they're strung together by trust, by courage, by vulnerability. That's what intimacy is. It's these tiny lights of connection. If I stood in front of you right now and shared, not mindfully, just shared something really hard that was going on in my life without any thought to what our relationship is, what our relationship can bear, whether you've earned the right to hear the story, whether the story is appropriate, it does not create little sparks of light. It's like as if I was holding up a floodlight and pointing at you. And if I were to hold up a floodlight and point it right at your face, what would you physically do? Okay, so let me describe what people are doing. People are putting both of their hands, they're squinting their eyes, they're squinting their whole faces, and they're putting both hands in front of their face. That's what we feel like when people inappropriately share with us. How many of you felt that before? Where instead of being like open and receptive and feeling connected and intimate, you're like, geez, whoa, TMI, too much information. And a lot of times we share too much information as a way to protect us from vulnerability. And here's why. I'm scared to let you know that I just wrote this article and I'm under total fire for it and people are making fun of me and I'm feeling hurt. The same thing that I told someone in an intimate conversation. So what I do is I floodlight you with it. I don't know you very well, or I'm in front of a big group, or it's a story that I haven't processed enough to really be sharing with other people. And I floodlight you with it, and you immediately respond, hands up, push me away, and then I go, see? No one cares about me. No one gives a shit that I'm hurting. I knew it. It's how we protect ourselves from vulnerability. We just engage in a behavior that confirms our fear. Does that make sense? We don't even give people the chance. Another kind of related to floodlighting is the smash and grab. And I heard this over and over, and I've seen it a million times, and it's very connected with social media in some ways. And that is when I just smash you down with some really hardcore information and grab whatever attention I can grab from you. Like, this is a story that someone was explaining. They were at work. They're in the break room. It was teachers. And they were saying, you know, they were talking about standardized testing and they were, you know, blah, blah, blah. And they were complaining. And one of the women said, well, you know, standardized testing is tough, but you know, my father tried to commit suicide last week. So there. And it was a total smash and grab. Clearly someone in pain. Clearly someone hurt, but their approach was not vulnerability. Was not, even if she was super good friends with all the rest of the teachers, that conversation would look like, hey, I know that this is a hard time for us because we're in the middle of testing, but I really need to share something that's going on in my life with you because I'm struggling and I have to be here because of testing, but I'm really struggling. And can we talk about this? That's a vulnerable, intimate conversation. You know, and a lot of times I think both the smash and grab and floodlighting is, how many of you, when people do that, feel angry like someone's trying to be manipulative and not respecting your boundaries? I think a lot of times what people are doing is testing the strength of a relationship. And of course, what we know, because we've been talking about it for, you know, a long time, is that it's not a fair assessment. And it goes back to something we talked about in the session when we talked about the differences between empathy and sympathy. How many of you know or have a sympathy seeker in your life? Someone who's always looking for validation that they have it worse than everybody else. Yes, do you know that person? Yeah, okay. How many of you are driven crazy by that? Honestly. When I interview mental health professionals, and I've interviewed in my sample at large, I have a huge percentage of mental health professionals. When I ask mental health professionals, what does it feel like for you when someone's sympathy seeking? I hear words like pissed off, crusty, angry, manipulated. Like, it's very difficult. Because let me play out that scenario for you. So what's going on, Brené? Nothing, just my whole life is just falling apart. It's just, everything has just gone to hell in a handbasket. I cannot pull it together. That sounds, you know, it sounds like you're really in struggle. Oh, yes, it sounds like I'm in struggle. Like, you have no idea what's going on. Well, I want to know. Well, yeah, that's cute that you want to know. That's neat that you want to know. But this is not like the other people you see all day long. This is tough. Yeah, this is really bad. It's this thing that, you know, it's a really hard situation to respond with empathy, because basically the setup is, I've got it so bad that you'll never get it. And that every time you try to get it, I'm going to crush you with how much you're not going to get it. What's interesting about the smash and grab, floodlighting, and sympathy seeking, what they share in common, what's really important to understand, is shame is often the driving force behind these. Because shame makes us feel very alone, and it's sometimes very hard for us to believe that anyone could understand what we're feeling, right? So it's very difficult to do that. And so one of the things I want to be careful about is that we don't vilify people who use floodlighting or the smash and grab or who sympathy. I mean, let me tell you, I've been a sympathy seeker before. I can tell you an exact story. First year in the PhD program, I called my mom and she said, how's school? How's it going? I'm like, oh my God, this is the hardest thing I've ever done. I mean, I am struggling. And she said, oh God. I said, I really have no idea what they're talking about. I was taking a multivariate linear statistics course and, hence qualitative researcher. And I was like, I'm not even sure I know what they're talking about. And my mom said, oh God, I hate that feeling. I was like, oh, I'm sorry. Did you take that class? Nice, eh? Yeah, right. She goes, well, no, but I'm like, mom, this is pretty serious stuff. She's like, well, okay, good luck. And she hung up. I didn't know until later that she called my sisters and be like, make sure you don't call Dr. Brené, you know, cause she'll remind you that you've never taken multivariate linear statistics. So really, really hurtful thing to say to my mom, right? Really, really hurtful actually. But so what was going on for me then is, oh my God, I actually don't know what's happening in this class. I'm already thinking that I got into this program on some kind of fluke. And when they find out that I'm not smart enough to be here, I'm going to die. Like, how am I going to explain that to people that I got kicked out and I've only been here for 3 weeks? Like, I am a total imposter. I'm a fraud. It's a joke that I'm here. Like, I get mean mode median, but I mean, just a little beyond that. You know, like, oh my God. They got calculators that I don't even know what the buttons mean. You know, like, this is a nightmare. I was in total shame shitstorm. So one of the things I would say to you is when you see floodlighting in the smash and grab, I don't put my boundaries down around that stuff. I mean, I'm not going to say if someone, you know, if I'm in the break room and someone says, well, you know, it's nice to see y'all complaining because you don't like standardized testing, but my dad tried to kill himself. I'm not going to apologize profusely for being worried about small things like standardized testing when this was going on in your life. But I'm also not going to assume that your intent was to hurt me, and I'm going to try to see struggle in that. You know what I mean? I'm going to try to practice empathy and be aware that it's going to be difficult to practice empathy because I'm going to feel like I was just smashed. The last one is cruelty, cynicism, criticism, and cool. And we talked a little bit about this in the earlier sessions, and I think that speaks for themselves. One of the ways that we avoid vulnerability is we're just mean-spirited. We're critical of everything. We're, you know, it's reflexive cynicism. Hey, I've got a really far-fetched, awesome idea. That is so stupid. You know, like there are words in our house that we don't use that are related to cool and cynicism, like lame, uncool, stupid. We live in a culture that's rampant with these ideas. And they are huge protectors of vulnerability. I don't need to put myself out on the line because my job is just to make fun of you. You know, and so I have a motto that I live by. It's a mantra that says, at the end of the day, at the end of the month, at the end of my life, I want to know that I contributed more than I criticized. You know, and I really believe, and this is binary and probably against everything that I've already said, but I really believe you're either making the world a better place or you're making it a worse place. That we don't have room for neutrality right now. That you're either walking in the store and you see a woman whose kid's screaming bloody murder, throwing Cheerios on the floor, and you either walk by and you go, ah, Jesus, you know, with this criticizing, damning look, or you walk by and as every person I know can do, you look, give them a look like, oh God, I've been there, sister. You know, you're on the plane, the baby's screaming, and you think you're going to come undone. Oh my God, I was on a flight last year with this kid. I swear you would have thought someone was ripping this baby's arms and legs off. They were screaming at the top of their lungs. And you could hear the people because they were in the bulkhead, which is don't get the bulkhead people because you're right by the business flyers who have no empathy at all. I'm sorry. And I know because I'm up there all the time and I do have empathy, but the rest of them are just like, oh, they're really tough. It's a tough crew because they're on the road all the time. And so you could literally hear this. Jeez. And this baby's crying. And all of a sudden this mother stood up and turned around and faced the entire flight. She goes, I'm doing the best I can. Yeah. And there had been a couple of us who had already, because I was sitting two rows behind her, and she had like a three-year-old, she had this newborn, she's clearly struggling, long flight, delayed. I had already held the baby once. I had already fished Cheerios out of her diaper bag. You know, you're either sighing or, you know, I guess you could be neutral and just put your bows on and not add to the, you know, but we're all in struggle. You know, any parent will tell you, you're going to smirk at the lady in the grocery store whose baby's going nuts. You better smirk fast. Because if you're there with your kid by aisle four, it's your turn. You know, it's your turn. We have to figure out a way to contribute and to be compassionate with each other and to support each other. And just things like, great skirt, the great skirt. You're welcome. You know, just kindness. Kindness. Because this is how we protect ourselves. There's a great quote. I'll leave you this session with this. A great quote from the movie Almost Famous, which I love. Isn't that a great movie? This is a great movie. That says, the only true currency in this bankrupt world is what you share with someone else when you're being uncool. You know, and to me, that's vulnerability, right? Yeah. So I'll see you all in the next session.
Program continues with Session 5, Guideposts 1 through 6 with Brené Brown.
So we've covered the vulnerability armory where we walk in and gear up. And now we're going to launch into the 10 guideposts for wholehearted living. And we're going to talk about how we take off some of the armor, what we have to let go of, what are some of the shame gremlins that come up as we start to practice wholeheartedness. And we're going to start from the beginning with the first guidepost, which is cultivating authenticity and letting go of what people think. Easier said than done, right? That's it. Next. Yeah. Wouldn't that be awesome if it were that easy? So just as a reminder to how the guideposts work, when I was going through the data and asking the question, what do the wholehearted have in common? What do these men and women who are living and loving with their whole hearts, who are really all in, who are showing up, what do they have in common? I described, like, you know, the do list and the do not list, which as I got into the research and the data further, it really was more nuanced and it was more about cultivating and letting go. And so the first one is cultivating authenticity. And in order to do that, the shame trigger and the vulnerability of that is letting go of what people think, which is very difficult. And so one of the things in grounded theory that we do is we look for words and phrases that we call them incidents that come up in the data over and over and over again. And one of the words that came up more than any other word across all of the guideposts was the word practice. Unfortunately. I was hoping that these were like to-do list items. Once, check them off. You know, I am authentic. Check. Authenticity was really very surprising to me because I thought going into the research that there were authentic people and inauthentic people. And authenticity was kind of something inherent in us. But that did not bear out in the data at all. And so what I found was that authenticity is a choice. And that people who want to be authentic, practice authenticity every day, and what many people told me, multiple times a day. It becomes a choice for them when they walk into a meeting, when they walk into their houses at night, when they, you know, that authenticity is a choice. And so I was very unsure about what authenticity really meant. And so what do I do when I don't know the definition of something? I make one up. So, and this is kind of a big honking definition because authenticity seemed to have a lot of properties to it. So this is the definition that I came up of authenticity from the data. Authenticity is the daily practice of letting go of who we think we're supposed to be and embracing who we actually are. Choosing authenticity means, one, cultivating the courage to be imperfect, to set boundaries, and to allow ourselves to be vulnerable. And I have to tell you, I want to stop and say a couple things about each of these. We got bookmarks made with the vulnerability definition on them. And when they were printed, there was like 20,000 of them. They were for a book tour. They did not have the phrase to set boundaries on them. And I said, we have to recycle them. I cannot hand these out because it goes back to something we talked about in an earlier session about authenticity is also about boundary setting. One of the most difficult components of practicing authenticity is setting boundaries. So it's the courage to set boundaries, to be imperfect, and to allow ourselves to be vulnerable, expressing compassion that comes from knowing that we're all made of strength and struggle, and nurturing the connection and sense of belonging that can only happen when we believe we're enough. Authenticity demands wholehearted living and loving, even when it's hard, even when we're wrestling with the shame and fear of not being good enough, and especially when the joy is so intense that we're afraid to let ourselves feel it. Mindfully practicing authenticity during our most soul-searching struggles is how we invite grace, joy, and gratitude into our lives. We talked again earlier about my authenticity mantra is don't shrink, don't puff up, stand your sacred ground. One of the things that I found in the research participants across the data, many of the people who really practice authenticity had a way to talk to themselves about it on the brink of those choices. You know, so one thing I invite people to often do is think about what is it that you could say to yourself, or how can you remind yourself when you're walking into a situation to be mindful about authenticity? You know, in an earlier session, I gave the example of my goal. I take one half of the room and my goal is to walk in and to fit in no matter what happens. And if I don't fit in, the result of that is almost always shame. The other half of the room, I really want to belong. I really want to fit in, but my goal is not to fit in at all costs. My goal is be authentic, stay authentic, practice authenticity. And I go and I practice authenticity and I don't feel a sense of belonging. I don't feel connection. It may hurt. I may be disappointed. I may even feel grief, but I'm not going to feel shame because the goal was authenticity. Let me tell you, you would be surprised perhaps to learn that when I write about authenticity, I get more controversial and heated comments than any other topic I write about. Because people say, if you have to talk about authenticity, you're not authentic. There doesn't need to be a conversation about authenticity. In fact, there's a very popular blogger who had one of the most popular blog posts he'd ever put up said, authenticity is the new bullshit. And I think it's interesting. I agree in a way because here's what happens. When words like authentic get co-opted, and commercialized, especially by the corporate sector. And we start talking about authentic leadership and authentic Fritos and authentic jeans and authentic underwear. We get burnt out on the word, right? I'm burnt out on the word. But to say that we don't need to have a conversation about authentic, that if you are authentic, you don't need to talk about it, reminds me so much of when people say, if you need to ask how much it costs, you can't afford it. You know, I know a lot of people who have a lot of money. They know exactly how much everything costs. You know, it's those of us who don't have a lot of money, who come from not having a lot of money, who are afraid to ask how much things cost. People who have a lot of money always ask how much things cost. That's why they have a lot of money. You know, so the idea that you can shame us into not talking about authenticity because if we were authentic, we shouldn't need to talk about it, is just doesn't, I don't buy it. I think the difficult part about having conversations about authenticity are people, you know, people say, like some of the comments I hear is, well, I was authentic at work and got fired. I think it's really easy to straw man a lot of these propositions. I would argue that that's probably not authenticity. It's anger. It's name calling, but it's not authenticity. Authenticity would sound probably something more like, you put me down and you put my work down in front of our clients in a big meeting. And I felt incredibly ashamed, and I can't keep working like that. But how much easier is it to name call? And so to me, when we're talking about authenticity, we're talking about a practice of, again, the theme recurring over and over of letting ourselves be seen. And so what is your mantra? What can you say to yourself when you're walking into a situation that is vulnerable, where you know it's going to be easier to be who people want you to be? Because let me tell you something about authenticity practice. As someone who's really been doing it for the last couple of years, pretty religiously, you are going to piss off a lot of people. You are going to frustrate a lot of people. The first time I started saying no to people, now I really appreciate you asking, but I can't do that. This is my boundary ring. Describe it for the folks who are listening or who are far away. It's a sterling silver ring. And in the middle of it, there's three smaller rings that spin. And I bought it for myself for my 40th birthday. And so I call it my boundary ring because when someone asks me to do something, my new rule is that I spin it three times before I say yes. And I recite my boundary mantra. I have a mantra for everything. You got a problem, I've got a mantra. Because you know why? Because saying yes is my default. Being the good girl, my default. Making you happy, my default. Being who you want me to be, it's my default. It's, you know, I'm the oldest of four again. And that's the good girl got me all the points and all the problems. And so I spin it. And my boundary mantra, I think, is really helpful. You're welcome to borrow it if it fits for you. It is simply, choose discomfort over resentment. Three times, choose discomfort over resentment, choose discomfort over resentment, choose discomfort over resentment. Hey, Renee, can you make 4 dozen brownies tomorrow for the bake sale? Choose discomfort over resentment, choose discomfort over, no. I cannot. Here's why. Because how many times have I said, and you always know when I'm lying, because my voice gets really high. Sure, I would love to. Peanut free, right? Yeah, okay. So then I'm home making the brownies. Hey, Mom, I'm making brownies for your damn school. And then how many of you know this woman? So here are your brownies. I hope you enjoy them. It was a lot of work. It was a lot of work, and I had a lot of stuff on my plate. So I really hope they help your bake sale. Because did I mention they were a lot of work? And it really, to be honest with you, put me out a little. But here you go. Enjoy. I mean, how many of you recognize that person? Right. How many of you have been that person? All of us, right? As opposed to how many of you, how about this person? I really can't. I appreciate you asking. I'd love to help out. So please ask again. Not a good time for me to do it this week. How do we feel about her? We respect her. right? And the only people who really despise her are the people who are going to say, yes, they can make the 8 dozen, 4 for her and 4 for, you know. But everyone else who's taking care of themselves respects that. Ask me again. I'd love to do it. I want to support your cause. I'll come by and buy some stuff. I really cannot make 4 dozen brownies tonight. My plate's full. So much about authenticity is about boundaries. It's about saying no when we can't do something. And conversely, it's about saying yes when we really want to do something. And the shame gremlin is saying, you really should wait 5 pounds from now to do that. Or you should really wait to try that NIA class when you're perfect. Go to 4 NIA classes when no one's looking. Then go to the NIA class with your friends and you'll know all the routines. You know? So boundaries are not just about saying no instead of saying yes and taking on more. It's also about saying yes. You know what? I'm going to always be too busy for this trip. Let's do it. Let's try it. Let's take it. And so much I think about authenticity is vulnerability. We take on things that we do not want to take on. Choose comfort over resentment. We say, I'd rather be comfortable in this 90 seconds it's going to take me to tell you no. And I'll resent you and be pissed off later and be the person I don't really want to be to avoid being vulnerable and uncomfortable for these 90 seconds. And that's why I think there's a part of authenticity that is really, you're going to terrorize some people and even people close to you. And some of the people that push back the most when you start practicing authenticity are the people who benefit the most from you saying yes all the time. It's a little bit of practicing fearlessness. It's a little bit of practicing, you know, and I have to tell you that I practice. And I mean, I practice. You think, like, I hope you, surely at this point together, you know that I don't have this all figured out, right? Are y'all clear on that? Yes. Okay. I practice in the mirror. Like a goofball. Thank you so much for asking. It's not a good time. No. Okay, that's not it. Thank you so much for asking. Namaste. It's not a good time. No, that doesn't work either. Thank you so much for asking. No, that's too dramatic. Thank you so much for asking, but the answer is no. You know, I practice 50 ways of doing it. And, you know, and I turn my ring and I get ready. But that's mindfulness. That's paying attention and putting something into practice. And the other thing I do that I think is, like, my dean has laughed at me on several occasions. If I have a big meeting that I have to go into or something that's difficult, I take notes. I take notes right in with me on a legal pad. Especially if it's going to be a difficult conversation. And every time without fail, someone will say, you have notes? Like, I'm supposed to be ashamed of having notes. To which I respond, yes, this is a very important issue for me. And I wanted to make sure I wrote down my thoughts so I could express them to you. I really want us to have some understanding about what's going on. And the best way for me to do that is to be prepared and write down some of my thoughts. Where are your notes? You know, like, you know, I always have notes. And I will actually, in a meeting that can be somewhat emotional, I'll say, just a second. Okay. I thought this might be come up. And, you know, because sometimes how many of you have found yourselves in positions where you want to be authentic and you want to say how you're really feeling, but you feel like the emotions are running roughshod over you and you can't get it out. And so for women, we have a tendency to cry or shut down or scream. And men, it's there's two options, pissed off or shut down, as opposed to staying engaged. Very difficult. The next one, the next guidepost we'll talk about is cultivating self-compassion and letting go of perfectionism. So some of these, you'll see that we've really talked about perfectionism and we've unpacked it. So let me try to describe this, because this is what's exciting to me about this Sounds True event and the recording. This is the first and only place that I can actually imagine this happening when all my work has really come together. I've never talked about the shame work, the wholeheartedness, and the vulnerability in one place before. And so what you'll see, you know, the vulnerability piece is really interesting because it's a chapter in my dissertation from 12 years ago. There's a chapter on vulnerability. It's all over. I thought it was just me. It's in The Gifts of Imperfection, and it's the focus of Daring Greatly, the new book. But I never knew really until a couple years ago that it's the core of what I do. I just always thought, keeps popping up. Put it back. It's like whack-a-mole. Choom, choom, put it down. There you go. Shame. Vulnerability is a big issue. Wholeheartedness. Vulnerability is a big issue. Just pound it down. So what you'll see as we go through these guideposts for wholeheartedness, you'll see many of the things that we have to let go of. In this instance, if we want to cultivate self-compassion, we have to let go of perfectionism. Many of the things we have to let go of are vulnerability shields. And the reason why it's so hard to let go of them is they're how we keep ourselves safe. Does that make sense? So if we talk about cultivating self-compassion and letting go of perfectionism. So what we've covered already on perfectionism is that it's not healthy striving. It's the 20-ton shield that we carry around. If I look, live, do, work everything perfectly, I can avoid or minimize shame, blame, judgment, criticism. So how do we let go of that? And I think the only way we can really let go of that vulnerability shield is by practicing self-compassion. I didn't know a lot about self-compassion, I'll be honest with you, until I started this research. And what's interesting, again, about the way grounded theory works is that we do the literature review afterwards. So what I ended up putting in into my academic search is I ended up putting in what I thought people were doing who were successfully overcoming perfectionism. Critical awareness. They were kind to themselves. I put self-empathy in. I put, you know, one thing I put in was emotional health. And so I started doing all these searches. Well, the first thing that comes up that is like 3 for 3, using different words that I would use, Kristen Neff works really. She is an associate professor at the University of Texas at Austin, but she works from a Buddhist mindfulness perspective. And so our language is very different. But because of the keywords that I put in the search, her research came right up. And so here's what Kristen Neff says. She says that there's 3 components to self-compassion. The first one is self-kindness. That we treat ourselves with, we're nice to ourselves. We're kind to ourselves. She articulates much more beautifully my whole idea that when I'm in shame, I try to talk to myself like I would talk to someone I love. You know, self-kindness. The second element, common humanity. This is what I would call practicing critical awareness. The second element of shame resilience. She said people who are self-compassionate have a sense of common humanity, meaning they know that their struggle is the struggle of everyone. Yeah, let me tell you something. 12 years in the shame minefield, what I can tell you is if you've got shame about it, it is probably pretty universal. I don't care if it's something you've been through, something you think about that you would never tell anybody, something, some smell that you have that you think is weird. We all think we're alone about the strangest things when we're very much not alone. And so she says part of self-compassion is understanding common humanity. And the last one is mindfulness. And I've always struggled with the idea of mindfulness. And I try really hard. And I read a lot of books on it, and I do that thing where like, how can you enjoy the peach if you can't enjoy a bite of the peach? And I think, I'm hungry and I need more of the peach. And I try so hard for the mindfulness thing, and it's a little bit, it just rubs up against my wiring the wrong way, because I'm more like, we can do this. And then I read her definition of mindfulness, which says, it's allowing ourselves to deeply feel what we're feeling, but not to over-identify with it. Which she was the first person I ran into that described mindfulness as not just an awareness or coming alive or a consciousness about something, but also the need to have that awareness and consciousness in perspective. It really even helped me with the peach. It really did. It really helped me that, oh, mindfulness is not you only get a bite of the peach because the bite of the peach is as good as the whole peach. The idea is it's about the comfort versus numbing thing. Every bite should be enjoyable. That's comfort. That's pleasure. And so to me, the whole idea of letting go of perfectionism and cultivating self-compassion, really that mindfulness piece of we've got to feel what we're feeling, but we also have to move forward and through it. And when we become stuck and we become over-identified in some, in an affect or an emotion, that's also not being mindful. Does that make sense? So those are her three components. And I think letting go of perfectionism is, again, just a practice. And for those of you who are her parents who are here listening, perfectionism is extremely contagious. The idea that we can be perfectionistic and not pass those straitjackets down to our children, I see no evidence of that at all. You know, if we're actively in our perfectionism, we might as well line our kids up, have them raise their little arms and slip those straitjackets right over them because that's exactly what they're learning. I have this terrible story that some of you may have heard me tell before, but it was so perfect. Ellen came home from school. She had worn one hairstyle to school and come home with another hairstyle. And when I asked her about it, she said that some kids had, you know, made fun of it or said it was out of style. And so she changed it. So I gave her the big speech on, but how did you like the hairstyle? And that's really more important. How did you feel about it? Not what other people think. You know, authentically, you know, how did you? And she said, I thought I looked really cute. And I'm like, that's what matters. How we feel is more important than what other people think. She's like, okay, that's hard, but okay. Like 10 minutes later, Steve comes in from the yard and he's been mowing the lawn. In my passive aggressive voice, I go, oh, are you done? And he goes, yeah, I'm wiped out. It's hot and tired. And I was like, there's still some lights, Christmas lights out. And he's like, yeah, it's not a big deal. And I was like, well, Christmas is over and I'm getting ready to put up the big metal heart for Valentine's Day. And it's just not acceptable when the holidays clash like that on the outside. And he's like, you didn't even see the lights. You didn't even notice them. They're not even plugged in. I'm like, right. But the neighbors can see them. Ellen's standing a foot away from me. And he's like, what do you mean? I'm like, right. Yes, I can't see them. They're great. They're on the banister. But the neighbors will be like, oh my God, she's crossing holidays out there. And Ellen just looks at me and goes, but how do they make you feel? You know, I'm like, oh my gosh. She's like, it's hard, right, Mom? I'm like, it's so hard. It's so hard. Okay. Guidepost number three, cultivating a resilient spirit, letting go of numbing and powerlessness. So we talked a lot about numbing and I'm not going to go back through it again, but I do want to talk about the importance of resilience. Okay. What is resilience? You know, in the 1970s, resilience became a big term studied by everyone from psychologists, psychiatrists, criminal justice folks. This is a big term. It simply means, what's your bounce back factor? Resilience studies are very interesting because if we look at two people who've gone through equally difficult things and see that one person has really come out the other side of it and is doing okay, and the other person is defined by it and cannot get through to the other side of it, we want to know, what are the factors that are in place for the person who is moving through it? And how can we instill those in all of our, in ourselves and other people? I got to be honest with you. I think a lot more of who we are is hardwiring than what we think. Having said that, I think the opportunity for parents, and I think the opportunity eventually for us as adults, is to leverage our hardwiring, to love our hardwiring, to embrace our hardwiring. An example of how this did not go well in my growing up life was that I am an introvert, which I know people find very hard to believe. But I am a fairly classic introvert. I can talk to you up here because I'm in my work and I really love my work. But if you put a disco ball in here and turn this into a cocktail party, I would be in the fetal position behind the stage. I could not glad handle and talk and make small talk and things like that. I'm not wired like that at all. A lecture hall is super comfortable for me, or an event, but I'm an introvert. I don't like small talk and I need lots and lots of time alone to rejuvenate and replenish. There are some people who draw their energy from groups being with people. And then there are other people who need to be alone. I need to be alone. Well, in my family culture and the culture I grew up in, really in Texas, and the fact that I'm very German American, introversion was seen as shaming. Like to be quiet, to not like to have small talk, to not be outgoing. Those things were not okay. I mean, you know, we were raised that by the time you could speak, you look the waiter in the eye and you order what you want to eat or you don't eat. And so one of the things that I believe that very resilient people have in common is they understand who they are and they don't try to be other people. They don't try to be another way because incongruent living is not sustainable. I think half of the numbing that we do is to try to, you know, from Facebook to foraging for carbs. I think a lot of the numbing that we do is to try to replenish ourselves because we're not living congruently with who we are. Like the chances are if you're, you know, I have a big family and so I spend a lot of vacation time with family, but if you invite us to a party in the neighborhood or a cocktail party for work, the chances of me coming are zero to slim. I just don't do that. But I used to because I used to drink. And that was easy. Honestly, how many of you in here started drinking as a social lubricant to feel more comfortable? I mean, that's why kids in high school drink, right? But when you strip down and it's just me, I don't want to go. I'd rather be at home with my family playing board game or watching Downton Abbey or alone thinking, reading, writing. You know, I love that. So I think part of resilience is understanding who we are, how we're wired, what are the gremlins that we have that have moved us away from that, and then getting back to congruent living. The other thing that I want to say about the whole idea of resilient spirit is about spirit. And so it's been a very interesting adventure for me as an academic to talk about spirituality. But I have to say across the board, wholehearted men and women are spiritual people. And I'm going to read you my definition of spirituality because I think it's really important. They are not necessarily religious people. They are not necessarily church-going people. But I want to be very careful about this too. They're not necessarily not religious, and they do go to church, some of them. You know, we have this idea about religion versus spirituality, and religion is, in certain circles, religion is really bad and spirituality is great. You know, I thought it was very interesting at TED that before it started, someone asked, how many of you are religious people? And I raised my hand along with three other people in an audience of 1,500. And then the second question is, how many of you are spiritual people? And then, you know, the other 1,497 or whatever raised their hand. I was like, I didn't know that was option B. You know, that's like total testing error. Cause I would have known the right reason. I would have known the right answer, especially, you know, in that crowd. But the truth is we have to be very careful as we think about a resilient spirit. Some people go to church or temple or mosque every week. Some people find God at a fishing hole. But what the wholehearted men and women shared in common was this. And this is how I define, I don't even have to look it up because I know what it is. Because I have to use it so often to explain what I'm talking about. I define spirituality as a deeply held belief that we are inextricably connected to each other by something greater than us. For me, that thing, something greater than us, is God. Again, for other people, it's nature. For some people, it's the human spirit. It's different for different people. But I will tell you that spirituality was an absolute huge pattern and theme among the wholehearted. So when we talk about resilience and we talk about courage and compassion and connection, what I think spirituality does for us is it gives us a sense of purpose and perspective. You know, for me, spirituality is inextricably connected to music and nature. And I like my spiritual music from singers who have probably woke up drunk in a lot of hotel rooms. I'm more of the Willie Nelson, Loretta Lynn kind of person, but we have to find what it is that brings perspective and purpose into our lives. Because one of the ways that I think we let go of powerlessness is to have greater perspective. This brings up another very interesting thing that I have never written about. I don't think I've written about this yet anywhere. Is about complaining. How many of you have a shame trigger around being perceived as complaining too much? Huge. Okay, so a lot of people. It's a major shame trigger. And one of the things that I've really recognized in the wholehearted men and women is that they complain. They're not afraid to say that things are going poorly or they're upset about something or work is really hard. But they do what I call piss and moan with perspective. You know, there's a way to complain and there's a way to vent that also lets people around you know that you understand the severity of your crisis. Does that make sense? And I think a huge part of this is a great example, Hurricane Ike. So I live in Houston. Hurricanes are a really big deal for us. So Hurricane Ike comes. We stay. We have no electricity for 2 weeks. And there's trees down our front yard. You really can't drive. There's no traffic lights. Everything is a mess. It's really a mess. And it's September, the end of September in Houston. So it's 95 degrees, 95% humidity, and mosquitoes as big as your fist. And you have to sleep with the windows open. And both of my kids come down with strep throat. And it was just a nightmare. So my friend Dawn, the therapist, who I talk about a lot, calls me from San Antonio and she said, I'm just checking in. How are you? And I'm like, I am really good. And I am so grateful because things could have been so much worse. Because, you know, people in Galveston, the Bay Area, they lost their houses, you know, literally. So it could have been a lot worse. And I said, you know, we have a generator. We're okay. And I'm really just grateful. She's like, pants on fire. That's exactly what she said. I said, what do you mean? And she said, oh my God, save that line for other people. I'm like, I am pissed off and I am hot and I am covered in mosquito bites and this is bullshit. I cannot do my laundry and you know, blah, blah, blah. And she's like, okay. And so, and what else? What else? Who would you kill? Give me the kill list. I'm like, oh my God, I would totally kill these three people right now. Kill them. Dead. Dead. And then leave their bodies in the backyard to attract the mosquitoes away from my house. She's like, awesome. And then what else is going on? Well, she said, what would be awesome? Like a shower and coming out of a shower into an air conditioning house. Oh, that does sound good. And what else? And yeah, and I'm like, okay. And then she's like, okay, what else? I'm like, that's it. She's, how do you feel? I'm like, I feel better. I feel stronger. I can do this. And she's like, yeah, save that whole I'm grateful thing for someone else. You just had like a hurricane go over the top of your house. You have sick kids, no electricity, no fresh food. You know, you get to be frustrated. And so it was this idea that there's a difference between me saying those things to her versus saying, I've got it worse than anyone else. And, you know, and me saying, you know, the people who lost their houses, well, at least they're not sleeping in a really messed up house with no air conditioning. They're probably at a hotel because they lost their, you know. That's problematic, right? But pissing and moaning with perspective is really, a lot of people with high levels of resilience do it. They get it out. They say what's on their mind, but they have perspective. Let's go to the next one. Cultivating gratitude and joy and letting go of scarcity and fear of the dark. And I think we really covered this when we talked about foreboding joy. But one of the big guideposts from the wholehearted was absolutely the cultivation of gratitude and joy. What is your gratitude practice? And again, I want to reiterate here, it is not an attitude of gratitude. And the example that I use all the time when I talk about this is yoga. I have a yoga attitude. I have yoga clothes. I live in yoga pants, actually. I wear yoga shoes. Somewhere in my house, I think I even have a yoga mat. I do not practice yoga. So if you ask me to do something up here, how far do you think my attitude of yoga will carry me in this process? I cannot. The same is true with gratitude. You can have an attitude of gratitude. What is your practice? What are you doing every day to put that out there? And when you start practicing it, What are you telling yourself? And when you get the vulnerability shivers, when you are faced with joy, how can you immediately go? I'm telling you, that practice is transformative. Instead of, oh my God, the other shoe, what's going to happen? Tempting fate, gratitude. Let's go to the next one. Cultivating intuition and trusting faith. Letting go of the need for certainty. I'm a work in progress on this one. So when intuition emerged from the data as a really important concept for wholeheartedness, I definitely thought, this is not me. You know, what does that mean? Intuition. My friends who are, you know, very intuitive, and they always say, well, my gut says, or this and this, make fun of me actually a lot for being so fact check person. I have a gut on things, and I have a really good gut on things, but I'm also a checker outer of things as well. And what was really interesting to me is when I went into the literature, sure that I was going to find that everything I was doing was contrary to wholeheartedness, what I found is intuition is really a combination of that gut thing, and it's a cognitive process. It's taking a situation and very quickly running through all of our experiences and seeing how and where it fits. And so the definition I built for intuition from the data is this. Intuition is not a single way of knowing. It is our ability to hold space for uncertainty and our willingness to trust the many ways we've developed knowledge and insight, including instinct, experience, faith, and reason. So I don't think, you know, how many of you, when you hear the word intuition, you immediately think instinct and gut? But intuition also relies very deeply on experience, which is data for us. And so when you have a strong intuition about something, you've run that through a lot of different places. You know, heart, head, I call the soul. For me, the soul is the place where your heart and your head connect. To me, it's where God lives for me. It's that intersection of what I know and how I feel. And so intuition is a huge part of wholeheartedness. And I think one of the things that happens for us is when we stop trusting ourselves, when our radar breaks, because we make decisions that don't pan out well, or there are consequences that we have not anticipated, we start to distrust what we think we know. And that becomes a very dangerous proposition, because let me tell you what that leaves us flat open for: the advice of other people. And so one of the ways I know that I'm in trouble is when I start polling people about what I should do. How many of you have had that experience? So when your inner pollster comes out, really, like, Gallup lives inside of me. Like, I am a serious pollster. And, you know, I'm a researcher, so I'm really good at polling people. But when that inner pollster comes out, I mean, the poll can be helpful, but when it starts overriding and it feels queasy, and I think you should take the job, and I think you should take the job, and you're crazy not to take the job, then we're out of balance. We've moved away from wholeheartedness. So there's two things that I think are big red flags around dismissing intuition. One is polling, and the other is the bull in the china shop, where sometimes we're so uncomfortable with trying to make a decision that we just say, screw it, I'll do it. How many of you have had that experience? Not knowing is so uncomfortable, I'm just going to do it. Like, I made a really bad, big decision in my life a couple of years ago based on that. I was so unable for some reason to sit with the discomfort of not knowing long enough to get to the right answer that I just said yes. And it was a mistake. And I felt bad the whole entire time. And so one of the ways I think we get back to intuition and faith is that we let go of the need for certainty. How many of you love certainty? How many of you want to snuggle up with certainty? I love certainty. I love it, but it's not real. And I'm telling you, our ability to sit and not know is a superpower. It is an absolute superpower. How are some of the ways that y'all deal with uncertainty?